Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is great cooking an art or a science? There's no question that taste is subjective and that it takes a certain amount of creative flair to combine flavors and textures in pleasing and novel ways. But let's face it, getting the ingredients of a recipe to behave the way they're supposed to, crispy here, velvety there, fresh tasting and appealing everywhere, requires more chemistry than alchemy. And that is what makes the process fascinating to food science writer Harold McGee. He writes the Curious Cook column for the New York Times, and his new book is called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Harold, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be with you.
This is not, in fact, a cookbook. Can you talk about what you set out to do here?
Yes. We've got lots and lots of recipe books, maybe too many to keep track of. What we don't have so much of are books that explain the processes and explain the ingredients so that we have a better idea of what we're doing when we try to follow a recipe. And in fact, a lot of recipes disagree on what the best way to do something is or what's going on when you do it. So I thought it would be useful to put together a book that doesn't contain recipes but explains what the ingredients are, what the processes are, what works and what doesn't.
What I love about it is that you explain why what works does and what doesn't. I think my favorite little subsection may have been about making your own mayonnaise, which is something I think I last did in chemistry class in high school. but it was such an interesting exploration of what exactly this sauce is that we all are so used to.
Yeah, and it turns out that, people find a way to make something that works, and then they end up saying that's the only way to make something. And mayonnaise is a great example. You look in recipe books, and they generally say, well, you can make one cup of mayonnaise with one egg yolk. What you're doing is breaking up some oil into little droplets to make a nice creamy, semi-solid sauce. And that struck me as being kind of suspiciously arbitrary, one egg yolk, one cup. So I thought I would just have fun and see how many cups of mayonnaise could I make with one yolk, and the answer turned out to be quarts. So the recipes that say don't, be very careful when you get close to a cup, otherwise you're going to break the sauce. In fact, you can kind of relax and make however much you want, and it's so much more fun to cook when you know that things aren't as critical as you're often being told.
What's in that egg yolk, Harold, that allows that emulsification to take place?
Two different things. One is emulsifiers. Phospholipids is the chemical name, and lecithin is a name of a particular one that people are probably familiar with, which are very good at coating oil droplets and keeping them from coalescing. The other thing is the yolk proteins. Egg yolk is actually lots and lots of little droplets of fat and oil, and that's exactly what you're making when you make a mayonnaise. So it's kind of prepackaged with exactly the ingredient you need.
Of course, we never want the yolk to be in the white when we're trying to whip egg whites and get them nice and stiff. But you point out that you've got to get most of the yolk out, but if there's a tiny bit, you don't have to throw everything away.
That's right. Many books will say don't allow even a speck of yolk into your egg whites. And it turns out that a speck is not going to do much damage. It's true that any kind of fat or residue, even of soap on a bowl, will tend to make it harder to make a foam. You have to work longer at it, but you'll still get one.
I confess I've always had kind of a hang-up about eggs because I worry about salmonella, particularly with my kids. You describe here the fact that it's possible in limited quantities to pasteurize your own eggs at home.
That's right. It turns out that the egg proteins don't really begin to coagulate until about 150 or so degrees, between 140 and 150. And it turns out that you can, if you can hold the eggs at, say, 130 to 135 for about half an hour or so and then put them back in the fridge, you've essentially killed the bacteria, any bacteria that might have been in there.
Is this something that you're doing frequently now, or do you still sort of take your chances when you cook something that might not have a fully cooked egg?
I don't worry about it for myself because I buy from a grocery that I've been going to for some years and a small production farm that produces the eggs. And even on a nationwide basis, the odds are something these days, something like 1 in 20 or 30,000 is contaminated. So I don't worry about it too much.
That's comforting, actually.
Yes.
My guest is food science writer Harold McGee. His new book is Keys to Good Cooking. If you've got a food science question, join us throughout the hour at 1-800-933-5372 or send your email to think@kera.org. You remind us to be wary of trusting the cooking times given in recipes, particularly when we're putting something in the oven. It seems like, you know, I press that digital readout on my oven. It seems like it should be 350 degrees, but in fact, it may not be.
That's right. You just never know with ovens. And part of the reason for that, even if the thermostat is accurate and the oven is a recent one and well-made and all those things, it turns out that in order to keep the oven at something like 350 degrees, what happens is the thermostat senses when the temperature begins to go below that, and then it turns on the heating elements. The heating elements are gas or electric, and they get up to 1,000 degrees or higher. And so for some period of time, whatever food is in the oven is feeling air that may be a little bit below 350, but it's actually feeling radiant heat that's much higher than that. And so what you end up with is an average over time that's kind of like 350 degrees, but in fact has been a mixture of different kinds of temperatures.
So check early and check often.
That's right. And it's a reason not to take timings in recipes too seriously. They're wonderful guidelines to give you a general idea, but there's no substituting for checking.
It's hard to imagine the days when people cooked things with wood stoves and ovens that they couldn't fully control the temperature at all, and somehow they managed to keep themselves well fed.
Yeah, well, in a way, you know, we're kind of talking about details. If the question is, can I make something that's nourishing that will keep us all alive, that's pretty easy to do. But I think we've become a little more particular about, you know, the juiciness of our cuts of meat and things like that. And we want things to be just right, and that's where the details really matter.
So when choosing between a gas and an electric oven, electric is easier to use and keep things the way we want them?
Well, they do behave differently, and so they're better at different things. A gas oven, because it has a live flame in it, has to be vented so that the carbon dioxide and the water that are created in the flame as the gas is combusted, those gases need to be able to go somewhere, and you don't want them to go right into the kitchen so that they're vented out. Along with that goes some of the moisture and air from the oven itself, and what that means is that gas ovens are not so good at retaining moisture when you're, for example, baking. And baking is a procedure where you really want a lot of moisture in the oven to begin with. In the case of cooking meats, you want the atmosphere to be as dry as possible. And in that case, an electric oven is very good. A gas oven is very good because it does allow the moisture to dissipate.
We have an email here from Eric who says, I've always been tempted to buy some black truffles to make a pasta dish. Any special way to prepare and cook these expensive delicacies? You don't want to ruin truffles.
That's right. And the thing to remember about truffles is that their flavor is very, very delicate, and so you really don't want to cook them. You want to chop them finely or grate them and put them into the dish at the very last minute. So they get warmed up by the other ingredients, but they don't actually get cooked. Otherwise, you'll just lose that aroma.
What about truffle oils? Are they worth it?
I'm not a big fan of truffle oils because, as I say, the aroma is delicate, and if you make an oil with just truffles, that aroma disappears pretty quickly. So almost every truffle oil, every one that I know of, is supplemented with pure chemicals to give you those truffle notes, which means that it's not really truffle oil.
Sounds far less appetizing when you say that.
Yeah.
Harold McGee is with us. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. The other day I was cooking a new recipe, and it's called puerco pibil, or slow-roasted pork. And the recipe called for marinating the pork in the refrigerator for 2 hours ahead of time. And I wanted it to have a lot of flavor, and I thought, well, maybe I should just marinate it on the countertop instead of in the refrigerator. And then that just brought up the question, what's the difference? And I've asked a couple of people that are really good cooks, and they don't know. So what I wonder.
What do you think, Harold? Is it safe to marinate on the countertop for a couple of hours?
Yeah, that's fine. Especially the marinade probably includes an acidic ingredient like vinegar or citrus juices or something.
Michael, what was in that marinade? Can you give us a basic idea?
It was some fresh squeezed orange juice and some fresh squeezed lemons, and then a number of ground up spices, seasonings, and berries and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, so the marinade itself is very acidic, and acid is a great way of preventing microbes from growing, and so that's perfectly safe. And I'd also say that even if it weren't especially acidic, a couple of hours on the countertop is not going to make that big a difference, so that would be fine.
I want to talk about your writing on salt. This was very interesting to me because very, very often recipes won't tell you what kind of salt. And people now use kosher salt or they use sea salt. Some people still use a good old-fashioned salt crystals. And the intensity is hugely different if you are measuring rather than weighing it. Is that right?
That's right. If you use our standard teaspoons and tablespoons and so on, then the difference between ordinary granulated table salt and kosher salt, which is very flaky, can be a matter of a twofold difference in the actual amount of salt and therefore the saltiness. The granulated salt is much denser, and so a tablespoon of that is going to be twice as salty as a tablespoon of kosher salt.
And the flavor isn't actually that different?
No, they're both 99.9% sodium chloride, and so the flavor is exactly the same. It's just the size of the granules and how much air that they trap. So when you're measuring by volume, you're measuring not just the ingredient but all the air around the particles, and that's why it's really much more accurate to use a scale.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest investments, or one of the most important investments you think we can make in the kitchen.
That's right. That and a good thermometer, because cooking is essentially taking ingredients and combining them in certain proportions and then heating them. And so measuring those proportions and measuring the heat are critical if we really want to get the right result.
And that old knitting needle with a compass on top that my grandmother had, that's not good enough?
They're not so great. In fact, I've got half a dozen of them in my kitchen, and they all at room temperature read different numbers. So that's, you know, one of the advantages of modern technology is that there are now good digital thermometers that give you a much more accurate idea of what's going on.
Do you need multiple thermometers, one for meat, one for candy, one for boiling liquids?
Not really. The modern digital thermometers have a good range. They'll go up to candy making temperatures, and as long as you've got a good one, and you know, pay a little extra for a good one, it'll last you and it'll give you better results.
Food science writer Harold McGee is my guest. He writes the Curious Cook column for the New York Times and has a new book out called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or submit your questions via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
Plano CFP. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Harold McGee is my guest. He's a food science writer whose new book is called Keys to Good Cooking, a guide to making the best of foods and recipes. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll go next on the line to Fort Worth, where we'll speak with Amanda. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, listen, I'm really glad you mentioned having a digital thermometer, because my mom and I recently made marshmallow cream from scratch for the first time.
Wow.
And it was a really fun process when all was said and done, but we were using a meat thermometer. And so I'm really glad you mentioned that. And my question is, you mentioned about you shouldn't be as concerned with timing. And I found that to be true in the mixing stage, because it seemed like it made more sense to watch what was going on than to mix for 14 minutes. So I just wanted your comment on that.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about that, Harold?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Recipes are essentially roadmaps. You know, they kind of give you directions to get to a particular place. But, you know, when you actually are in your own kitchen, you have to use your own ingredients and your own tools and heat sources and things like that, all of which are going to be a little different. And the weather may be different. In the case of candy making, that's an important variable. So you really do have to trust your own senses and have an idea of what you're looking for, and then go by that and not just by the numbers.
So many people are making sweets this time of year, and so we have a lot of questions about that. Beth in Fort Worth writes, please discuss using ice water or hot water in pie crusts and butter versus lard.
Okay. Well, ice water is generally called for in pie crust recipes in order to minimize the development of gluten when you form the crust, because you don't want the crust to be tough. You want it to be tender and flaky. And so the less gluten development, the better. And one side note on that, because you use very little water when you make pie crusts, that can be a difficult thing to do, to get that water evenly dispersed in the dough without kneading a lot. And kneading also develops gluten and makes things tough. So something that I found really useful is to use a water sprayer and measure out how many sprays it takes to make one tablespoon of water, mm-hmm. and then add the water to the flour that way, and you can get it much more evenly dispersed, and you don't have to knead as much, and you end up with a tenderer crust. And then as far as lard and butter, lard is easier to work with, has better melting characteristics for getting that flakiness, but they also have a very big difference in flavor. And some people love lard pie crusts, other people much prefer butter, so I think that's the most important question.
You're a big fan of making your own butter. First of all, how different does it taste than those waxy sticks we can buy in the grocery store?
Well, it depends on the cream you start with, mm-hmm. And how quickly you have it. But what it does have is a wonderfully fresh flavor, something that's very hard to duplicate in store-bought butters. But I would say that, you know, it is a little bit of trouble. It's a little bit messy to make butter at home from cream, basically making whipped cream and then intentionally curdling it. But it is a lot of fun, especially with to do it with kids. But you can really improve the flavor of store-bought butter tremendously simply by scraping off the outer millimeter or two, which is almost always oxidized and rancid just from sitting around a long time.
So the paper or whatever it comes wrapped in isn't good enough?
Whether it's paper or foil, what you can do is scrape a little bit, and what you'll see is that you'll get down to a part of the butter that's much, much lighter in color. And that darkness on the outside actually comes from dehydration and is a sure sign of rancidity.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Camille, who wants to know, what does scalding the milk do when making yeast rolls? Can this step be skipped, or what will happen if it is skipped?
Well, there is a kind of tradition for scalding milk in baking for a couple of reasons. One is simply to get rid of any bugs that might have been growing in the milk, and of course that would date from quite a while ago. We don't really have to worry about that so much anymore. There's also a feeling that the whey proteins in milk can sometimes interfere with the proper rising of a loaf of bread. That at least was a theory that was proposed some decades ago. But I think these days it's felt that that's really not an issue. So I think it's a dispensable step.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Lisa in Glen Rose. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My husband and I have an ongoing argument about the leaving the milk out. He doesn't want it out on the counter for more than 5 minutes, and he'll go ballistic. And I grew up, it stayed out on the counter, and, you know, all through dinner for an hour, you know, I wouldn't leave it much longer than that, but he just thinks that, you know, somebody's going to get sick. And I'm like, well, I grew up in a family of seven, and nobody ever got sick when we left the milk out for more than 5 minutes. So I was curious if bacteria can grow or what the situation is there.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Harold?
Well, bacteria will certainly start growing faster as the temperature warms up. But the thing is that the bacteria that are going to grow in milk at ambient temperatures are not bacteria that are going to make you sick. They're just going to make the milk taste not so good and get kind of curdled. So it is true that the milk will retain its quality much longer if you keep it cold. But if you're drinking it, finishing a carton, say, within a day, make much of a difference.
We should say also that you are a big, you advocate turning the refrigerator down to like 32 or 33 degrees and the freezer down, I can't remember what the exact number is, but lower than a lot of people might keep their fridge and freezer.
Yeah, it turns out that many things that we keep in the fridge keep best right at temperatures around the freezing point. Mm-hmm. The lower the temperature, the slower things go bad. And so for meats, for milk and other dairy products, fish, all of those things are best kept right around the freezing point. And so what you can do is another little kitchen tool that I like to have around is a non-contact instant read thermometer, which you kind of point and shoot at surfaces, and it tells you very quickly, immediately, in fact, what the temperature is. Use one of those to get an idea of the kind of temperature landscape of your refrigerator, and try to get the coldest part of the fridge right around 32 or so, and then you can keep other things in other parts, but keep the meat and fish and milk in that coldest spot.
And when it comes to freezing things, they tend to freeze up better if they're in a prepared food as opposed to taking the raw ingredients and freezing them individually.
That's true, because if you think about raw meat or raw fish, for example, you know, when you thaw it, it leaks a lot of liquid because mm-hmm. the ice crystals have damaged the tissue, and so you end up losing a lot of the goodness of the meat and fish that way. If you cook the meat or fish first and then freeze it, the cooking process has already dried the tissue out and changed it in such a way that it's much less likely to be affected that way by ice crystals. And so you end up with a better result cooking the food first and then freezing it.
Harold McGee is my guest. The new book is Keys to Good Cooking. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Bruce in Grand Prairie. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I have a fairly new convection oven, and it has three buttons on it for cooking. It has broiling, roasting, and baking. I understand broiling, but I don't really get the difference between roasting and baking. And let me add that when I set it on bake, it actually, if I set it to 350, the temperature gauge only goes up to 325, and I'm not sure, I know it has something to do with the convection, but anyway, can you explain some of that to me?
Boy, that's a good question. My understanding of cooking in the oven is that it's baking if you're cooking bread and roasting if you're cooking meat. We use the same term. You know, roasting really should mean cooking outdoors some kind of chamber associated with fire, and instead we've got it domesticated in that way. That sounds to me as though, you know, nomenclature that the manufacturer has chosen that really doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It might have to do with which heating elements in the oven come on. Maybe, you know, a couple of them come on for roasting or baking and only one for the other, but I couldn't tell you which is which.
We have an email here from Lynn who writes, I love homemade muffins, cookies, sweetbreads, etc., but struggle to get the balance of baking powder, baking soda, and salt to yield the correct texture, taste, and appearance. Can you please give some tips on when to use these ingredients and the results that they give?
Well, that's a very big question since there are so many different kinds of things that you can make with them. But the important thing to remember is that baking soda and baking powder are two very different materials. Baking soda is an alkaline material that needs an acid in order to make bubbles, which is what we're using these things for, to leaven baked goods. So with baking soda, you have to have an acid ingredient to balance it. Baking powder is baking soda plus the acid that you need in order to balance it. So baking soda, baking powder can be used in almost any recipe. Baking soda always has to have an ingredient that will provide acid, and that can be anything from buttermilk to vinegar to cocoa. Natural cocoa is acidic and will provide that acidity. But that's the basic distinction to remember.
I had never seen until your book a recommendation to check out one's water to see if the tap is putting out water that is a little bit basic or a little bit acidic.
Yeah, it turns out that different municipalities, or if you live in the country, different wells give us water with very different pHs, very different balances of acidity and alkalinity, and that makes a big difference in cooking, it turns out. If the water is on the acid side, then it'll actually make vegetables cook more slowly, but also lose their color more quickly. So it's actually better to have water that's neutral or slightly on the alkaline side for cooking vegetables, and it's worth knowing what you've got.
So is that why they say sometimes to throw in a little bit of baking soda when you're boiling vegetables, if you're doing it that way?
Yeah, although sometimes that's way overdone. And if you do overdo it, you'll end up with green beans, for example, that are the most vibrant green you've ever seen. But you put one in your mouth and it falls apart.
Huh.
So you have to be very judicious in the use of baking soda.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Frank in Dallas. Hey, Frank.
Hi there. Yes, good afternoon. Great show. Mike, you know, I'm talking about the Mexican peppers. I love, of course, the poblano and the jalapenos. Talking about the poblanos, can you freeze the poblanos and then defreeze them? And does it change the molecular structure and the taste of the poblanos to conserve them?
Are you talking about fresh or after they've been
the
roasted?
The fresh poblanos, yes, because that's one of the things that I like. And sometimes if I delay on cooking, then of course they get kind of mushy. But I was wondering if you can freeze peppers, and also if you have to defrost them naturally, or what would be the case?
Let's find out.
Well, I'm afraid that freezing poblanos is going to do instantly what letting them sit in the fridge too long will do eventually, which is turn them mushy.
Huh.
So when you freeze things, what happens is the water in that food turns into ice crystals, and the ice crystals are these little hard things, and they puncture the cell walls of the food, so that when you then thaw them, all the juices run out of the cells, and you end up with something that's limp and a little bit mushy. So I'm afraid freezing isn't going to take care of the problem. I think what you could do, though, is go ahead, as we were saying earlier, cook a dish, take a Saturday, cook a big batch of whatever it is you use the poblanos for, and then freeze them in that form, and they'll be fine.
Where do you store your herbs and spices?
In a dark corner of my kitchen. I have kind of a pantry area that doesn't actually have a door, but is protected from direct light.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important thing, is to keep your herbs and spices in a place that's dark and as cool as possible.
It's funny that so many of them are sold now in glass jars, which looks pretty when you're sort of walking down the store aisle, but not the best thing for what's contained inside.
Exactly. It turns out that the energy and light can turn herbs and spices stale very quickly, which is another reason for buying them whole rather than pre-ground, because that way the parts inside will retain their quality a lot longer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Danny in Plano who writes, if you believe the advertisers, our kitchens are unsafe and we need all types of chemicals to kill bacteria hiding to do us in. Do we take cleanliness too seriously or not seriously enough?
Well, I think in general we don't take it seriously enough. Because, you know, the kitchen in a home is a place where lots of other things go on besides food preparation. We'll pick up the newspaper off the front porch and spread it out on the kitchen table to take a first look at, and you don't know what's on your porch. So things like that, I think, are worth keeping in mind. You don't really need chemicals from cleaning companies to keep your kitchen clean. Actually, vinegar is a really good way to sanitize the surfaces of countertops and so on. You don't need to be crazy about it either, but it's good to be aware of the fact that what ends up on those surfaces will end up on the foods that you're preparing, and it's good to keep that in mind and keep things as clean as possible.
I'm guessing you're not a sponge guy.
I'm not a sponge guy, partly because I noticed years ago that after, you know, a week or two, they really began to smell.
Yeah.
And if you smell something coming out of your sponge, you know there's something living in there very happily.
Ugh. paper towels, is that a good solution? A lot of people are trying to get away from things that are disposable. Is it okay to have the same washcloths washed over and over to wipe down the counter?
You know, they do make these days these wonderful, very thin cloth scrubbers, and you still want to use something with a little bit of, kind of an abrasive plastic coating on it to get really difficult stuff off of pots and pans. But for a lot of things, including drying off countertops, one of these very thin cloths does really well, and I've had one now. I've been using the same one for a couple of months, and it's pristine. So as long as something can be impregnated with soap and then rinsed thoroughly and dried in a matter of an hour or two, it'll be a good helper in the kitchen.
Harold McGee is with us. His new book is called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is food science writer Harold McGee. He writes the Curious Cook column for the New York Times and has a new book out called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Join us at 800-933-5372. Next on the line, we have Julie in Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hello. I've got a question about leaving butter out on the counter in the Dallas area. It gets pretty hot in the summertime, even though we have air conditioning in the house. Is it safe to leave butter out all the time, or does it have to be refrigerated?
It's safe to leave it out for on the order of days. The thing is that at warm temperatures, the outside will oxidize and become rancid a lot faster. So it's not best for the ultimate quality of the butter to do that. It'll keep its quality better if you keep it cold.
We had another email asking about the sort of butter keepers that are submerged, where the butter itself is submerged in water. And this is something you write about in the book.
Yeah, those do work because they protect the surfaces from oxidation, and that's a good thing. It is true that the water needs to be changed pretty frequently because the butter does contain some residual protein and sugar from the milk, and those end up in the water, and then bugs can start to grow on that in the water. They're friendly bugs, but they produce sour flavors. They're the same kinds of things that make milk into yogurt and that kind of thing. So again, you want to refresh the water pretty frequently.
Are we wasting our money frying things in olive oil?
Well, that's a question I asked myself a couple of months ago, and then wrote about it in the New York Times. We're inundated with lots of wonderful olive oils these days. It's actually a nice change, so people are now saying, rather than saving good olive oils just for drizzling on salads and so on, we should be using it to cook. And I was just curious about what would happen to the wonderful flavors of these oils when you cook with them. And it turns out that once you heat the oils to about 300, 350 degrees, which is standard for frying, the oil ends up tasting like any other frying oil. And so there are still good reasons to use olive oil in cooking, but if you have an especially nice one with an especially nice flavor, you should realize that's not going to come through, and you'll need to drizzle some on at the end in any case.
And if I remember correctly, you felt like canola oil was good enough for almost everything you tried.
Well, yeah, it turns out that olive oils, of course, because they are taken special care with, they're more expensive. And canola oil is among the least expensive oils out there. It has a very good content of omega-3 fatty acids, which are important to us. I think they make a very good, ordinary, everyday frying oil.
Let's go next on the phone to Granberry, and we'll speak with Deborah. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. My question is regarding cutting boards. I am looking for a good quality but thin cutting board, and, of course, one that's easily taken care of, because I'm not very tall. So if I get a tall, thick cutting board and put it on my kitchen counter, it just makes it really difficult to even reach the cutting board. Your comments are appreciated. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, there has been a long-standing controversy about whether wood or plastic is better, and the fact that it's a long-standing controversy, I think, indicates that either is fine. And then when it comes to ease of taking care of it, of course, plastic cutting boards you can put in the dishwasher and clean that way. Wood doesn't stand up to that very well. But they do make these days composite materials that are kind of a cross between plastic and wood that can be put in the dishwasher. And they do come in fairly thin thicknesses. They're maybe, I don't know, about a quarter of an inch thick and very, very durable. So you might take a look at those.
We have an email here from Jessica in Fort Worth who wants to know the difference between the buttermilk you buy in the store and making buttermilk or a buttermilk substitute at home by adding a tablespoon of vinegar to regular milk.
Okay. So buttermilk is, generally speaking, these days something that is cultured. It's made with bacteria that thicken the milk the way that vinegar will. Because the bugs produce acid, and vinegar is an acid. That's why the two of them will thicken the milk. But vinegar will make the milk taste like vinegar. And these bacteria that are used for cultured buttermilk actually produce buttery aromas, aromas that just kind of enhance the natural flavor of the milk itself. So you'll get a similar kind of texture, but the flavors will be very different.
And occasionally, I suppose, when you're making your own butter, you do have some buttermilk to spare. What's the best use for that?
True buttermilk from actually making butter is something that you'll only really get if you make your own butter yourself, because the so-called buttermilk that we buy in stores is actually just skim milk with these bacterial cultures added. So true buttermilk is wonderful for baking because it has a lot of emulsifiers, things that do two different things. They help with the leavening process, and they also slow the staling of baked goods. So if you bake with buttermilk, the bread or the cake that you make will stay fresh much longer.
Sort of a non-chemical preservative.
That's right.
Let's go next to Linda in Dallas. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I would like to find out about starting baking items in a cold oven. I was made the keeper of my elderly aunt's pound cake recipe many years ago, and it never turned out really at all like hers in texture. It seems like since I've tried starting it in a cold oven, it's closer to what she used to make.
Yeah, it turns out that for a lot of things, including, surprisingly, popovers, which you would think require really high heat in order to get that burst of steam to make it nice and light. Lots of things that you bake in the oven, you can start in a cold oven, and they do just fine. I've never actually heard of the texture of a cake coming out better when it's started in a cold oven. That's a new one on me, but it's certainly true that because foods take a while to heat up in any case, and the oven is going to heat up faster than the food is, it turns out to be a perfectly good way to bake.
We have another email asking about the best way to get a high dome muffin, and should muffin and cake batter be refrigerated before they're baked?
Okay. A high dome in a muffin is it's best gotten if you fill the muffin tin level. Don't underfill it. Mm-hmm. And then you want to use a fairly high baking temperature in the oven, because that's going to cause the outside to begin to set while the inside is still rising, and so you're going to end up with that kind of central eruption.
Yeah.
Refrigerating the batter ahead of time is, to my knowledge, not essential. I've certainly done it most of the time without pre-refrigerating it, and it works fine.
You had a great tip in here. I have always assumed that if you open a bottle of wine and it's got that cork taste, that you just have to pour it out. But sometimes it can be made a little bit better.
Yeah, it turns out that wines that have been whose flavor has been spoiled by bacterial contamination of the cork, so that you end up with something that tastes like a dank cellar. That dank flavor can be removed very simply by taking a piece of plastic wrap and just swishing it around in the wine for about a minute. And it turns out that the molecule that makes that bad flavor is very similar to, in chemical terms, to the molecules in the wrap. And so it just sticks to the wrap, and then you remove it along with the wrap. And it's not that you make the wine wonderful, but you take away the thing that was making it unpalatable.
So I have to ask you, did you discover that yourself, or did someone tell you, and were you waiting for the next time you had a corked bottle of wine so you could test this out?
The second. It was figured out, I think, by a wine chemist. Mm-hmm. And I heard about it after it was already kind of old news to a lot of people. And then you're right, I actually was hoping for a bad bottle of wine so I could put it to the test.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with, let's try Becky in Dallas. Hi, Becky.
Hello. We've made brownies for a long time, and they are the rave of the town. But lately we get a thin, light crust on the top, and we haven't changed anything. We wondered what causes that.
Uh-huh. That thin crust comes actually from generally from overbeating, or for beating the mix for a long time. So my guess is that even though you think you're doing exactly the same thing, you might actually be spending a little more time beating the mix. So give that a try. Try just, you know, folding the ingredients together minimally, and see if you don't get a better result.
So that's why I'll confess I've only ever made brownies from a box, but they tell you not to overmix. Is it that they're trying to, they're trying to prevent just that?
Yeah, probably that. And also, if you overmix, you can end up losing some of the leavening, and so the brownies will end up even denser.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to the phones once more, and this time speak with Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I want to talk sourdough for a second here. A lady friend of mine a few years ago gave me some sourdough starter, and I asked for her instructions. I've added to it and made more of it. It stinks like nobody's business. And I'm just wondering, I want to make sourdough pancakes. Is there anything in there that would make a person sick? And if so, would the heat of cooking it in the relative short time of making pancakes would that render it safe to consume? Thank you for your time. I'll listen to my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, the bugs that give us the flavor of sourdough are perfectly safe. They're, in fact, in the same family as the ones that give us yogurt and buttermilk, and we have those bacteria and all, and they're just fine. In fact, some people think that they're actually healthful. So there's nothing to worry about in the sourdough culture. You can make wonderful pancakes with sourdough cultures, and in fact, you can use a little bit of baking soda instead of baking powder, and get all the leavening because of the acidity of the dough, and they're wonderful.
We have a good question here for Texas about grilling. In the great debate, writes Tom in Dallas, in the great debate between gas and coal grilling, I've heard various opinions how one is better than the other, the primary being that some people can taste the gas in propane-grilled food. And Tom wants to know your opinion on that.
You know, it turns out that is true. And propane does have a distinct taste. And if you have a grill whose burners have been badly adjusted so that you're getting incomplete combustion, if the flame looks kind of yellowish rather than completely blue, then that means you've got some incomplete combustion going on, and that means that you're ending up kind of along with the flame spraying some propane onto the surface of the food. Mm. Now, propane is very volatile, and most of it goes away right away, but some of it can apparently get embedded into the surface of the food, and then you can taste it.
All right, I think we have time if we go quickly to take one last call, this one from Candace in Duncanville. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Chris.
Go right ahead, please.
Okay. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
My question is that I use a lot of full-fat butter and cream cheese in my cakes and baked goods from scratch, and I wondered if it would make a difference to my recipes if I used the low-fat option of cream cheese like the Neufchâtel cheese or the low-fat buttermilk instead of the regular full-fat buttermilk.
What would change, Harold?
Well, a couple of things, the flavor and the texture, and those are, you know, the two reasons we love baked goods is their particular delicious qualities. So the question is whether they're going to change enough that you're going to notice a difference and not like it. So what you could try is a mixture, you know, try dialing back on the full fat and using some of the lower fat and see if you notice a difference. And if you don't, keep going until you do and stop there.
Is there anything that even you had to do over and over and over to finally figure out exactly how it should be done?
Almost everything.
That's very comforting, actually.
Yes. Yeah, no, cooking is, it is possible to talk about it in chemical and scientific terms, but foods are the most complex ingredients that that human beings work with. You know, when you're manufacturing, cars or something, you're working with metals, alloys, which are just two or three ingredients. And when we sit down to stand up to cook a steak, we're working with a lot of different things, trying to get them all in balance at the same time.
I'm sorry we're out of time, Harold. The new book by Harold McGee is called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. It's been such a pleasure, Harold. Thank you so much.
For me too, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.